Blog Talk Radio.
Rising report, it's that Apple report. It's the Rising Apple report. Rising report, it's that Apple report. It's the Rising Apple report.
Yeah! And an excellent good evening to all you Messian folk out there. This is the converted Mets fan, Sam Maxwell, and you are here with the Rising Apple Report. This is a very special episode for us. It's a spring training episode, and what better way to come at you with somebody who lives all of that spring training episodes, and we're going to get some firsthand accounts here. But before we do that, I have to have a shameless plug. Two Boots, which is a pizza place at Citi Field, is going to have a new slice this year, and it's called the Mojo Rising. So for many of you Mets fans, you know what Mojo Rising equates to. That is the 99 season, and just that era when they were playing that element of the song L.A. Woman by the Doors, and Jack Morrison going to Mojo Rising. Well, the slice certainly gets my Mojo Rising. It has cat lafrita steak, onions, mushrooms, provolone, mozzarella, no sauce, and also red pepper pesto. And I just have to say, you guys have to check that out when you go to Citi Field this year. That is arguably the best slice of pizza I might have ever had. Pat LaFrieda steak really drives it home. But that was my shameless plug before we bring on our Rising Apple writers. Now, Rising Apple writers, to start it off with, all the way up in Connecticut, is Rich Sparaga. Rich, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Sam. You know, it's always a good day when Major League Baseball spring training games start officially today, and the Mets start in less than 48 hours. So the world can't be a bad place when that's going on, right?
Oh, that's absolutely right. It's nice to see intra-squad baseball. And as I like to always say, the Mets can never lose intra-squad baseball. And that really, you know, really hit home back when, you know, spring training was like, all right, here comes the 2013 season, here comes the 2011 season. But now we have a season to really look forward to. And let me keep going with my writers of Rising Apple, and that is the next one is the Brooklyn Trolley blogger, Mike LaColan, coming from Bensonhurst in Brooklyn. Mike, what's up, Brooklyn?
As we like to say around here, how are you doing? I'm cool, man.
And that's the perfect way to segue out, Brooklyn all the way. JT Turan, who is new at the Rising Apple Report, but has already made quite an impact. JT, we're happy to have you here for the second podcast of yours.
Yeah, man, happy to be here. I'm about to see if I can find me a hog, just like the one that Cespedes has picked up, because he made me kind of hungry, just seeing like that barbecue that he's probably making, so...
Well, I hope you didn't kill the pig right away, but, you know, we can get into animal rights activism later. Without further ado, I'd like to welcome on our featured guest of the evening, and that is Mr. J.J. Newman. J.J. was drafted in the 35th round of 2006, a year that certainly has, you know, memories for plenty of Mets fans there. And, J.T., you were drafted in the 35th round. You played a little golf. Rookie league baseball in those first couple of years. What happened to your Mets professional career?
Hey, first of all, how's everybody doing? And appreciate you guys having me on. What happened? Basically, three games in, I remember we were playing the Dodgers. In fact, Clayton Kershaw was pitching the game. It was the year he got drafted also in the first round. But we were playing against him. And I went to turn a double play and tore my MCL and was out the rest of the season, basically, but still got invited to Instructs that fall, even though only playing a handful of games. I think I came back and I played 12 games after being rehabbed and everything else. But then made it up through spring training, was all healthy through there, and ended up making it on the 40-man roster towards the end of spring training. And, you know, I think as anybody knows, it's a 35th-round pick. That's kind of unheard of that soon. But I think they needed somebody to mix the Gatorade in the jugs or something like that, so they called me up to do that for a couple games, which was a good experience. But ended up tearing my MCL again and having to rehab down in Florida. And, you know, it came down to a point where people don't understand, you know, the psychological side of an injury. I'd never been injured my entire life, and I played, you know, Division I baseball and in high school, a big brand of baseball in West Virginia. But the psychological side, when it happened, it was kind of, you know, earth-shattering to me. So it was one of those things that I decided to retire early and pursue other avenues, you know, helping children and stuff like that.
And that's fantastic. So that's what you generally do these days?
Nowadays I'm doing I'm a baseball analyst for an ABC Sports affiliate in West Virginia, right outside of Pittsburgh, on TV. So I do that. They said I basically have a face for radio, though. They say don't get on TV, but so I do that. I do that a little bit, and I do private lessons and baseball camps, you know, around the country and everything, trying to stay busy. So I stay involved, and I even have my own charity event every year that I put on back in my hometown, where I invite some of my, you know, athlete friends and actor friends and stuff like that, and we put on a softball children's home in my hometown. It's actually a boys orphanage. So, you know, I try to stay busy, and I love working with kids and being around kids and helping them grow. And, you know, I was always very fortunate. I've got, you know, an amazing family with two older sisters and brother-in-laws that, you know, took care of me. And I never really had hard times, but I grew to understand other people do. So the fact that I made it, you know, with baseball and stuff, I learned that I had a platform to show people that, you know, it's possible to get here. And I like to get that word back, you know, to kids and stuff, so they don't think that it's not possible. I want everybody to know you work hard enough, you know, you can get to where you want to and you can get your dreams. So, you know, it's enjoyable to do that. I love working with children. So that's what I spend most of my time doing.
You know, and you bring up a great point just regarding the baseball world. And I was looking on something, you know, just some random Facebook posts where a Mets fan that I know posted about how the Yankees had to put this, like, you know, motivated people, human beings only, or something like that. And they put this thing that just seems standard to put into a ball club. And, you know, the Mets fan was certainly chastising the Yankees for it. But there was a comment on there which basically said just like millions of dollars isn't motivation enough. This is why I don't follow baseball, because these people don't know what it's like in the real world, or something along those lines. And I immediately responded to him that the majority, first of all, the reason why they're making millions of dollars is because for a long time, players were as working class as ever, so those players can eventually make $1 million. And the majority,
exactly,
you know, only 700 million, excuse me, 700 people generally make a relatively major league salary. Everybody
yeah.
else is working class grinding here with this sport, and they love the sport, and that's what keeps them going. And so I thought it was a very ignorant comment by that person, and I think you're a good example of how, even outside of, like, you know, you injured yourself and unfortunately your professional major league career didn't work out, but you're still passing on what you know, and that's the game, and that's the game you love, and you're making people's lives better. Try to get them aware of how this game can also help to make their lives better.
And Sam, that's a great point too, because, you know, throughout my career, I've met a ton of just a different type of athletes. You know, there's a lot of selfish guys out there, but there's also a lot of great people. And I've spoken with you many times about some of my friends in football and basketball and things like that. And we all kind of gravitate towards each other in the fact that we, you know, we got to a certain part in our lives. We made our dreams come true, whether it was for a brief moment or even, like, you know, Dominic Hickson, who did it for 9 years, 2 Super Bowls. you know, we all did our dream and we made that happen, but we all have the same commitment in giving back and being the type of person that when we walk up to a kid or a kid comes up to see us, that we're welcoming and smiling and never turning down a picture or never turning down an opportunity to help that kid and talk to him, you know. And if you look at, you know, like my sisters and brother-in-laws, and if you look at Dominic's family and a bunch of our other buddies' families, you can tell that was ingrained in us in a long time. You know, this is your goal to do this, but you have to put yourself second a lot because there's people that need you and are going to look for you for strength and look at you like, okay, if JJ did it, I know I can. And that's one of the biggest things, you know. When I got to that point when I got hurt the second time, it was, okay, what am I doing here? What's my real goal? What did God put me on here to do? And honestly, I could not be happier now giving back to the community I'm from, even giving back to New York. I do charity events up here also, and just helping kids. You know, that's the biggest thing for me. And even though you might think I'm a jerk, Sam, every time we talk, you know, I've heard you say, JJ, you're mean and everything else, but no.
Hey.
I love putting a smile on people's faces and, you know, giving back what I can.
Well, let's be honest, for making up all of that, I've said nothing but good things about you, to you.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's funny. So you're talking about face for radio because I've heard you make a joke about how good looking you are. But, you know, that's bar talk right now. When I met you in the park, next to Food Cell Kitchen, shameless plug, everybody. So before I get on to my next question, I want to pass it on to our other Rising Apple writers who certainly have some questions for you. So I'll, without further ado, I'll start with Rich Spirago. Rich.
Hey, JJ, and again, thanks for joining the Rising Apple Report. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, appreciate it, Rich. I'm doing better now, man. I get to talk to you. I was tired of talking to Sam. I'm glad somebody else gets to talk to somebody else now.
So that's great. So JJ, you know, a question I had that I think people might be really interested in is, when you were in Mets camp, can you give us one or two names of people, whether they were players or coaches, names that our listeners and even myself would recognize, who people who really helped you? You were just talking about how you like to help other people, which is great to hear. But who might be a player or a coach, a recognizable couple of names who maybe taught you something, whether it's a life lesson, a baseball lesson? Can you just share who was really good to you?
Well, I'll tell you, and that's one of the easiest questions I've ever had to answer because people have asked me the same thing. Who was your favorite person to play with and who was your favorite teammate? And basically that's the same question. In camp, the best guy I was around and somebody that you can tell right from the jump that he gives everything back is Pedro Martinez. The second I showed up the first day, they said, be at the stadium. It was 8:30 in the morning. For team breakfast and everything else. I show up, it is 7:15, I believe, and there comes Pedro pulling in an Aston Martin, and then here comes it's a mini bus behind him. And I'm thinking, what is going on? Is this like one, you know, how Cespedes is showing up on horses one day and Lamborghinis the next day, and it's a show, basically. I'm thinking, what is going on here? And here, Pedro went and got the whole Boys and Girls Club of America, the Boys and Girls Club of America down in Port St. Lucie. He got a bus sent to him and brought him to spring training that day to work out with him. He was rehabbing at the time. And he gave him all breakfast, gave him all lunch, did the whole workout with him. They got to stand on the field. He threw the ball with him and then took him bowling afterwards. And it was one of those things where, you know, I was raised a certain way, and we've gone over that, to give back and everything, but to see it at that level where – a guy like Pedro doesn't have to do anything. He's set for life. He's got enough money. He's got whatever he wants. He doesn't have to do anything. And the fact that, you know, he's willing to give back and not forget about who he really is and what he loves to do. And talking to him in his broken English, Spanish, funny accent that he has and his personality, you see that. Like he's that type of guy who loves putting a smile on people's faces. When he walks in a room, he's got a glow about him. and just being around him that little brief time, you know, a couple weeks, it was like, wow, this guy, you know, what a great guy. And there's other guys, you know, I wouldn't talk bad about anybody, but there's guys that get there and do their jobs and worry about their family and go home and do that every day. And that's how they play the game. But to see somebody actually go out of their way to make sure these kids were taken care of. And it wasn't just that occasion. He had kids there almost every day that he was rehabbing and working out because he wasn't pitching in games or anything else. So it was amazing to see that. And then, you know, you got your veterans that take the minor league guys out all the time. And El Duque was another good guy who was always asking questions about me. And at that time, my nephew, I just had a nephew. He's 2 years old at the time. He would always ask, hey, in his broken English, my nephew's name's Colin, but he'd call him Colin. Oh, how's Colin? He would make it a point to come up to my locker every day and ask him about him. And, you know, he signed a ball for him to Colin and, you know, all this other stuff. But he just, these people really, you could tell how humble they were. And, you know, with the records that El Duque has and the name he has and Pedro Martinez, you wouldn't expect that. And it was great to see that. And he had a huge impact on how I looked at my future and how to treat people and how to give back. So it was an absolute pleasure. And I've ran into Pedro a couple times in New York City since then. Still remembers me. We go talk together and share a couple laughs and just a wholesome guy. Really great guy. So to answer your question, I would say Pedro Martinez and then El Duque on the backside of that.
I'll tell you what, that is absolutely great to hear, you know, for me as a fan and other fans listening, to get a little bit of insight as to who Pedro and El Duque really are, and that's who they really are. You know, the story about
right.
Pedro with the kids and the buses, that tells us something, that he's not number 45 on the mound doing a job. He's a good dude, and we would not know that. And so from my perspective, JJ, thanks for sharing that story.
Oh, man. And like I said, any gospel I could spread about Pedro, because and even just like Sam was talking about the Yankees fans and stuff, there are fans out there that think it's just on the field. And so they can't stand there, get on Pedro, and they do things like that in certain players. But it's not just on the field. That doesn't just make the player. You know, that makes the athlete and the guy that's on the field, that's great. But there's so much more to people than that. And Pedro made me realize that, because I was in the same boat as a lot of people where I just saw the dimension where he's on TV playing. I didn't see the dimension of him, you know, picking kids up and running around the field and, you know, tickling them and tackling them on the ground and stuff like that and playing with them and, you know, changing lives, basically. So, yeah, it's great to talk about him. He's always a good guy to have around, too.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
That's
oh, you got
absolutely
it.
And the thing about it is that those two players are, you know, we probably would have won a World Series had it not been for them falling apart. And Omar Minaya probably thinks about that at a certain point. When you hear El Duque, when you hear Pedro, it's very bittersweet, because you wanted, like when they got Pedro Martinez and when they got El Duque, the reasons were to go deep into October. And we went rather deep without those two players. And at the time, I remember thinking to myself, you know, when they first went down, I'm like, this is a big deal. And it did end up being a big deal. But when you at the time, you had John Main and Oliver Perez stepping up and helping to fill that void, although it didn't, unfortunately, push us over the top, it still
right.
was... So that had something to do with those players, like you said. There was something to El Duque, and there was something to Pedro Martinez. And they would have been the difference between those years being what they were and those years being possibly a couple championships.
Yes. Oh, yeah, and them coming in just – and, you know, you talk about now, they're doing so many studies on players and how – what an asset they are to teams and their demeanors in the locker room and their presence around the team and stuff like that. Like, if they did those 10, 15 years ago with those two guys, they would be 100% A-plus to have around the team. There was never a day, even if they had just lost the game, they were guys that, yeah, they wore their emotions on their shoulders, but they were never pointing a finger at any other teammate. They were never doing anything. And, you know, they were always that presence to help you to the next level. They wanted to make their teammates better. So those guys, you know, I couldn't speak highly enough of them. And you brought up like a John Maine and guys like that. It was in that 2016, it was so injury ridden, you know, with Moises Alou was hurt at the beginning of spring training, which is one of the reasons that I even got up there. It's just, and Dan Murphy also came up with me that year, but it's just to have that presence in a locker room with a Pedro Martinez. And even when you watch him right now on TBS Sports and analyze baseball games, you can tell he's a joke. He's like Shaquille O'Neal on the NBA courtside. He just has that personality about him. He's infectious. You want to be around him, and he puts a smile on your face. But that year, yeah, they definitely had all the tools. You know, Jose Reyes, David Wright was hot at that time. You know, they had all the tools to go. Didn't work out, though.
No, it didn't. And it's fueled the entire Mets narrative ever since. But the 2015 team may have changed that, and the 2016 team might be even better. I'm going to pass us on to Mike Lacola. Mike, what is your question for JJ?
Well, I want to keep this in the civilian sector. You know, baseball and the climb up the ladder is tough. And I'm assuming that, and I want JJ to either confirm or deny that. It just seems to me that, you know, being a minor leaguer, being a fresh prospect, it makes strangers of many players in a strange land. It's a difficult life. I think you need a strong support group behind you. For many, this is their first time away from home. And, you know, it brings on new challenges in life as people progress from those teenage years. For some, their college years. For others, their high school years. And now you're in your first professional endeavor. So, JJ, please, if you will, can you please elaborate on the climb or life as a minor leaguer?
Well, I'll tell you, and that's a great question also. And you brought in all the variables there. You're not in a locker room. Like a lot of people, you get a business or you get a job in New York City. You're at that job with 90% of the people, I'm sure, spent 4 years in college. And then, you know, they're 22, 23 looking for the same job. And you're around people like that. Baseball is 100% different. The second I showed up, I'm 21 years old in this locker room with 17-year-old Dominicans that just signed for $1.5 million as free agents. Juan Lugares, Ruben Tejada. There was a bunch of them, and they're giving these guys, you know, $750,000, $1 million, $1.5 million bonuses. So imagine being 17 from another country and an organization hands you that money. Your mindset is, okay, you're a little bit cocky, you're confident, everything else. But you're in a room with guys that just got done playing at Florida State for 3 years and LSU and just won a national championship. So it's funny just to sit back and see the entire picture and the difference in all the players. Myself, you know, from high school, I went to a Division I school for 2 years and then got drafted the next year out of a Division II school in South Carolina. So I had that, and I played all over the country in between. But it was crazy to sit back. And then the road to get there, you really do find out who your true friends are that were on the team and, you know, who's supportive when you get called to that next level and they don't. You know, and then if you have to come back or you're injured, you find out. And I tell you this right now, Murphy and I go up the first time, and Murphy ended up staying, but I got hurt and came back to minor league camp. I mean, it was just like, I had an X on my chest, and I'm one of those guys that likes making people laugh and stuff. And 90% of the guys were cool, but there was, I remember, not going to say this guy's name, but we had just drafted him out of Auburn, or signed as a free agent out of Auburn. He was a second baseman, didn't say a word to me. And it's kind of like, wow, okay, so this is how cutthroat it is to get to the next level. And on top of that, just the demand every day. I remember being at the field at 5 a.m. for team breakfast, early work at 7 a.m. for an hour, which might just be standing at second base, and they're shooting 100-mile-an-hour balls out of these tires so you can catch and tag and practice that for an hour, then go to hitting, then go to your team drills until midday. And I remember playing in a single-A spring training game until 3 o'clock, getting dinner at, it was like 4 o'clock, and then they asked me to go to the triple-A game at night and play. So I was literally at the stadium, played two games. I was at the stadium from 5 a.m. until 11 o'clock at night and had to work out with the AAA team afterwards in the facility. So when people say, oh, you know, these guys, they're hot-dogging it. They're making millions a year, and they're doing this and that. And they're living the life. They have no idea. And I got friends, you know, it's a joke because now my schedule's so whack that I could sleep till one day and have camps the rest of the day and be on TV at night, and they'll be like, oh, you have life. I'm like, I wish I worked a 9-to-5 every day, you know, instead of being at a field in 90-degree humidity, changing uniforms three times and going through drills all day and stuff. And then say you have an away game, you're on a bus with 40 guys that are hot and sweaty from playing in Florida all day and everything else. It's just, it is a grind, and it's going to test you mentally, physically, and any other way that you can be tested. Now, at that same point, you're compensated very well and everything else, and it is the game you love. And that's why, you know, that day, there were like 3 days in a row where, you know what, I love doing it. I love being there. And that saying, you know, if you love what you're doing, you don't work a day in your life, that's true, because I look back on those days and I'm like, wow, I was so fortunate to be able to do that. But the climb to get there, it is not easy. And they say, you know, first rounders, they've got it easy. They do that. No, everybody does the work. Everybody shows up early. Everybody has to put their time in, and they have to do it. Now, I was very fortunate at the time. Tony Bernazard was with Omar Minaya. He was his assistant. And he loved Dan Murphy and I. So you could see even in the locker room, he would walk in, shake a couple of the Dominican. He was a Dominican guy. So he shook a couple of Dominican guys' hands, would come up, give me a high five, Murphy a high five, and literally walk right on out. So there's politics. I happen to be on the right side of it at that point. But, you know, that ladder is still, it's still hard to get up there. So to answer your question, it's not a easy task, but if you're there for the right reason, it is. But it's still physically hard, if that makes any sense.
It makes total sense. What a brilliant answer. Thank you.
Hey, you got it.
And, JJ, before I move on to our next writer, I just want to follow up with that. Do you think that part of the way the Mets ran things at the time had to do with the arrogance that is just the entire franchise? And maybe they do you think it's like that still, or do you think they have kind of learned from how arrogant they were and how quickly they fell?
You know what, and that's it. It's, you know, to be that arrogant, you better have something to back it up. You just can't come out that arrogant with nothing to back it up. You know, and at that point they had so many guys and so many names on the roster, but hadn't accomplished really what it is to act that way. You know what I mean? The New York Yankees the past 10 years, they had something. You get a couple World Series under your belt, you can act a certain way. You can compose yourself a certain way. The Mets didn't have it at that point. And, you know, the way that Omar Minaya wanted us, obviously, was to be very confident in what you're doing and your job and your capabilities and everything else. And you could tell that even with him driving by a practice when he came around you, he portrayed that. You know, I had a college coach down at in South Carolina at Erskine College. He did the same thing. He was the type of guy that wore his Oakleys everywhere, whether it was raining or shining. You know, he'd flex his muscles a little bit. But he also he played for the Philadelphia Phillies for a while and held the record for most home runs in a game at Alabama. And he'd done a lot in his life to accomplish his cockiness, he called it. But his goal was to portray it. And he's told me a million times, he said, I want my team to act this way. I don't want my team to ever be scared. I want my team to be on top of things. I want them to be confident, cocky, arrogant, whatever it takes, so that they have the confidence to compete at the highest level. I don't want anybody to fold whenever the going gets tough. So there's pluses and minuses to that, Sam. And, you know, at that point, I felt like the Mets were trying to portray that. But with injuries and everything else, it just didn't happen for them. Now, if they come back this year, they should have a little bit of swagger. You know, they did a great thing last year. They had a great run. And I think they learned a lot about themselves also with some of the moves they've made in the offseason to this year. You know, they've earned themselves a little bit of swagger. As you can see, Cespedes riding into spring training on two horses today with Thor. And that's hysterical, and it already is presenting a relaxed atmosphere and, you know, an atmosphere of fun and confidence. And that's what you want to see, especially as a baseball player. You can't play uptight. You want to be relaxed and as confident as possible.
Right, exactly. And it's a good segue to what's going on in current spring training. But before we go there, I want to pass us on to JT Turan. Before we finish up with the Rising Apple roundtable, go ahead, JJ.
How's it going, JJ? Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
What's going on, JT?
Hey, man. So one of the things that I obviously I love to just, you know, talk to ballplayers about any time I've gotten a chance to talk to them about is their approach to the game, the day of the game. Were there anything, any specifics, like, for example, like superstitions or maybe things that you had to do on the days that you played games, or maybe like the way you approached every at bat, like your batting stance, your whether it was your actual size, the bat, the weight, kind of like, it, you know, just give me a little bit more background as to what you like to do on those game days and if that was something that you conscientiously thought of to do something specific, or it was just kind of like whatever, however it went.
JT, are you kind of talking about in Bull Durham how he had to wear his girlfriend's underwear and stuff on the mound? No, you know what? There's a lot of guys that are very superstitious. I mean, in college, I slept with my bat a couple times.
Nice.
You know, the second I got it, the coach handed it to me, I slept with it. I don't even know what that meant, but it just felt good. And as long as I kept on hitting home runs, we were fine. So I kept doing it. But I got to a point where I wasn't superstitious. There's certain things that, you know, I did before pro baseball, like make sure my cleats were cleaned every single game, like no mud on them. They were clean as a whistle. Shined up. Everything about my uniform was clean. Everything about my glove, I was just a clean looking guy, looked professional already. And then, you know, you get to that level and people were cleaning your cleats for you, which was kind of cool. You know, you walk in and, oh my gosh, everything's shined up and clean and the jerseys are ready and, you know, my workout gear's ready for after the game and everything. So they took care of that part. But as far as anything else, I had a little bit of an open stance and relaxed, and my sister makes fun of me. She goes, you know, your nephew, my nephew's a little goofball just like I am. But she goes, every time I watch him stand, he's got the same butt wiggle you had whenever you were standing in the box. So I guess he gets up there there was a couple, you know, players' wives that said, why you wiggle your butt so much and all this other stuff. But apparently I had a little bit of a butt wiggle up there at the plate. But other than that, you know, I was kind of a boring player in the sense of I didn't have any superstitions. I didn't have to, you know, like they're talking about Justin Turner now, his wife takes him to eat French toast before every home game and stuff. I didn't do that. I didn't do that. I did make sure after every game, no matter who was there or wanted a picture or an autograph, I was always there for it. You know, whether it was in minor league camp and people were just stumbling by or whether it was at the big league stadium, I was making sure that no matter what, I wasn't leaving until everybody was satisfied. And, you know, it's a selfish thing. It's very enjoyable for me to do that. But it's also, I was that kid, you know, I remember being at Three River Stadium in Pittsburgh trying to get autographs and being scared to death to ask Barry Bonds and Bobby Bonilla and Andy Van Slyke for autographs and see them walk by. So I knew that feeling. I wasn't mad at them. I'm just thinking, okay, they got better things to do. I wanted to be, you know, I always sat there, just waited till the last picture, the last autograph, whatever people needed. If I could give them game cleats, if I could do whatever, I made sure I was at that. I was that guy. But as far as superstitions, no, not really. You know, I would get off of a game and text my brother-in-laws, and they'd usually make fun of me after games for something. They didn't even watch the game, and that was about it. So nothing real interesting. I was a pretty boring guy other than that.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for that answer, JJ.
Oh, you got it. Yeah.
Yeah, that basically sums up every answer that has happened so far, JJ. And it's been real interesting. And it's, you know, transferring to this Mets team, you know, you've been bringing up the whole horse thing so much. I mean, you know, Seth Bennett has been going on a rampage with these horses and these cars, and I think it's been awesome. I think that everything is coming together. You see the win-win from both his perspective, and it's interesting that I'm still thinking along that line as his team and the Mets team. But, you know, it seems as if there's been this marriage that has worked perfectly between what the Cespedes wants and what the Mets need. And that's what I've kind of seen with this entire thing, and seeing with the person who's designing his cars and the people who's taking pictures of these cars and the car company. I've just been seeing a win-win situation from both. So, you know, as this spring training has been going on, and I'll start with you, JJ, you know, is this a plus or a minus for this Mets team?
For the Mets team, and that just goes right back to the confidence factor and the relax factor that you want your team to have. And right now, Cespedes and his contract, he's earning every single dollar doing that. Because for one, if I just had a bad night, you know, say the wife and I got in a fight or my kids were sick or something bad happened in the family, and I'm showing up to the stadium the next day and I see my, you know, top three pitcher, Noah Syndergaard, 6'9", coming in on a horse with my Dominican buddy Cespedes, and they're just strolling into the stadium on a horse and waving and having a good old time, they just already brightened my day up. And they made spring training worth it just to even show up that day. You know, so that in itself is great. I love it. And him with his car showing up, that's awesome. Let the publicity, you know, handle itself and let the mainstream media do what they want with it. But as a teammate, that guy is who I would compare to a Pedro, trying to put smiles on his face, a fun-loving guy, you know. And I think we all wanted to jump down Cespedes' throat when he dropped the fly ball in center field in the in the game last year. But, you know, people make mistakes, and right now he's earning every penny of his contract. And it's great to see. Every time I wake up, I get text messages either from my lessons or from friends. Hey, that Cespedes guy's nuts. Is he that fun to hang out with outside of the stadium and this and that? And unfortunately, I never got to meet him, but it looks like he's having a good time. And, you know, you want your team to be in that atmosphere. You want them having fun. That's what this game's all about. You want them having fun. You want them laughing every day. Be relaxed, because you're going to play your best when you're having fun and you're relaxed. You know, so if you see a lot of ploys, the Cubs, I forget what they did today, but the manager showed up in a hippie bus or something like that, and they're shooting pies with a clown across the players and stuff. You know, that's the type of atmosphere you want your team around. You want them having fun. You want them relaxed, and they're going to operate in the best that way. And just an example of that, I remember Dominic, my best friend, got traded to the Carolina Panthers, and he called me the first day after practice. He said, JJ, this is completely different from the Giants. I said, well, what? He goes, well, for strength and conditioning today, they brought out a boxing ring out in the middle of the football field, and we had to box each other. I was like, well, that sounds like a recipe for disaster. But he said, no, they had a blast. They were out there going at it and boxing. He said that was their strength and conditioning. And he goes, there's no way Coach Coughlin would ever let that fly. But Riverboat Ron Rivera down there in Carolina, he had them boxing and everything else. I said, but that's fun. you know, that's that keeps your team relaxed. That makes it enjoyable. If two guys don't like each other, let them get in there and box it out for a little bit, you know, whatever. But stuff like that, that keeps the team up. So I'm happy to see that happening now. That didn't happen as much when I was there. You know, we all went out, we had fun, and we were relaxed. But it's just it's great to see that now.
Well, I'll tell you, for the New York Football Giants fans on this podcast right now, they probably want to have a whole nother podcast regarding that entire situation. But you know, I'm going to ask you before I move on to Rich and what he thinks about the entire car and horseman. I want to ask you, JJ, because it brewed back into my head just now about your affiliation. Now, you know, baseball players, I think at some point, you know, they have to affiliate with something different than they grew up with. So you grew up near the Pittsburgh Pirates. That sounds like it was your team. I was looking up some stuff about you, and you've talked about the Pittsburgh Pirates on air. So I've also met you, and
yeah,
you seem to have an affinity for the Mets. And like you were just talking about when Cespedes, you know, dropped that ball or didn't lift his shoulder, really, his left shoulder, You had a very fan reaction to talking about that. So, are you a Mets fan or a Pittsburgh Pirates fan?
It depends who's paying me that night, Sam. You know what I mean? So,
good answer. Shameless plug. That's what we like here. Shameless.
Hey, you want me to be a Kansas City fan? Fly me out there and give me $100. I'm going to be a Kansas City fan. Whatever you want. No, to be 100% honest with you, I love where I'm from, Wheeling, West Virginia. It's right outside of Pittsburgh, and I didn't necessarily grow up a Pirate fan. I love Barry Bonds. I loved Andy Van Slyke. Going back there and being an analyst, you know, and talking about them every day is truly awesome. It's great, and my agent at the time before was representing Andrew McCutchen and a couple of other guys coming up through. So it's just, it's, and my family loves them. My nephew loves them. So, you know, it's a joy for me to do that. But to be honest with you, the team I grew up loving is the New York Yankees. And there's only one, and not even necessarily a team, but I was the first movie I ever saw was The Babe with John Goodman playing Babe Ruth. And I absolutely fell in love, and that was it for me. So I wasn't necessarily even a Jeter fan or anything else, but I like seeing them win. I was a Babe Ruth fan. So even to answer your question, I've never really liked a team in particular, but I started loving players. And that's when I definitely knew I fell in love with the game itself and not just a team. I was a fanatic or anything else. I loved how Babe Ruth played. I've got a whole storage unit, collections of, you know, from posters to cards to plaques to Steins, everything Babe Ruth. And I just started falling in love with players. You know, I enjoyed watching Derek Jeter, enjoyed watching, you know, Andy Pettit pitch, guys like that. Enjoyed watching all from Mike Piazza, Ken Griffey. Loved it. So I wasn't necessarily a fan of anybody. But, you know, the correct answer is the Mets. But, you know, just really just became a fan of the game. I like when people play the game right. I like when they respect the game. And that's even in my lessons. I teach kids, hey, you know, don't roll the ball to me, throw it to me. And things like that. Just respect the game. And I love watching guys on TV do that. You know, and even the guys we've named already, like a Pedro Martinez, you know, you see him. They have fun out there. They're having a great time, also respecting the game, and you can tell they love what they're doing. They're earning every penny, and it's just a joy to watch. And that's what made me fall in love with Babe Ruth. After watching that movie, I had to see more of him and video clips of him and just be a part of that, and that's kind of helped me raise myself in my own baseball career and how to do things. And so to answer your question, yeah, whoever wants me to talk about their team, that's great. But, you know, I'm partial to the Mets and the Pirates, but I'm really not a fan of anybody. But, you know, I do hope the Mets go far this year. I would love to see them take it. I actually do think they're one of the top three teams, if not the top team in the league this year. And I'm one of a lot of analysts don't see him there, but am partial to him. But I think the pitching staff is great, and they should go far. So this year I'll root on them. But whoever wins the World Series, I'm probably going to hop on that bandwagon.
Hey, I hear that. Now, JJ, you're so good that I can only go to Rich right now with this. I think that, Rich, I'm going to preface this by saying I want to hear your opinion about the entire suspense and horse thing and car thing. But I want you to finish after you give that opinion with another question for JJ, because I just think that JJ is so fascinating. We all have follow-up questions for him. Rich, I'm going to go to you now. Go ahead. The whole suspense, the horse car thing, and then JJ.
Well, you know, from my perspective as a fan, I thought – that whole thing was handled perfectly well by both Cespedes and the Mets, and I'll tell you what I mean by that. Going into spring training, like JJ said, you know, these guys are athletes. They're essentially entertainers. They work really hard, all that stuff. But this isn't brain surgery. You know, people's lives aren't on the line here. So why not have some fun with it? It was early in spring training. It was right around the time the position players, when it all started, right around the time the position players had to report, and Cespedes had some fun with it. You know, he rolled up in some really flashy cars, a different one every day. It became a story. It became a lighthearted story. What's he going to do today? You know, a subtle benefit of that is everybody was paying attention to Mets camp, and I don't just mean in New York. You know, the national guys, too, ESPN was doing it. What's Cespedes going to do today? Boomer and Carton here in New York would break into their normal shtick and say, oh, we have it. You know, Cespedes rolled up in an Alfa Romeo today. So given the context, right? Right. So given the context, right early on in spring training, having fun with it, it helps the team. It calls a little attention to Mets camp in a lighthearted way. Fans loved it. Everybody loved it. Everybody got a good laugh about it. And going to the next step, the Mets handled it right. Okay, you know what? We had a lot of fun with that. It was 6-7 days of it. I'm sure that Sandy and Terry kind of pooped their pants today with those guys riding it on horses, because I know people who have fallen off horses and hurt themselves.
Yeah,
so
totally. Sandy's like, don't fall off, Noah. Don't fall off.
Like, right. I mean, they're actors and actresses. Yeah, well, falling off horses. Right, you know, so they did it for 6 days. They got all those benefits. Today it was like, okay, that's a great way to end it. You know, he rolled up in these cars, and now he's going to roll up on an animal, and that's a great laugh at the end. And now it's time for us to stop, because you know, at some point, it wasn't going to be funny anymore. And at another point, like Terry said, it is time to get serious. So everybody, I think, involved in this thing handled it perfectly well. The team got benefit out of it. Cespedes got some benefit out of it. Syndergaard, you know, was all over the fact that Cespedes is his main man. They rode up together in the horses today. All good. And before it got old and all that stuff, the team put a stop to it and said, okay, you know what? Now we're going to focus on our objective, which is the unfinished business. So kudos to all of them. Perfectly handled, top to bottom. That's my opinion. My question for JJ coming off of that would be, JJ, could you picture, and I'm honestly, could you picture yourself doing that? I mean, are you, is that consistent with your personality? So if you were in camp this year and you were buddies with Cespedes and he said, hey, dude, you know, we're going to bring this thing to a nice close tomorrow. You and I are going to ride up on a couple of horses. Is that consistent with your personality, or are you more the kind of guy who'd be like, oh, that's just not me, man. Find somebody else. What's your take on that?
Well, first of all, you guys kind of hit home with me with Sandy being all about him saying, listen, get off that horse, you might be hurt, because Sandy made me ride a horse every day. So that makes me believe he wanted me to get hurt, so I get out of there. But I'm joking. But you know what? You can ask, and I always talk about my family. You can ask my sisters and brother-in-laws and a couple of my best friends. Every year, I'm the guy that dresses up to Christmas, and I wear a different Cousin Eddie outfit. So Cousin Eddie from the Christmas Vacation movie, and you see it, it's on my Instagram and Facebook. I dress as a different Cousin Eddie character every year. I come out of the bathroom, surprise, you know, the crapper's full and everything else. I go through the whole deal. And, you know, I'm going to keep the locker room talk sacred because I did some stuff in the locker room trying to make guys laugh. And I was that guy, you know, that was a little bit of a class clown and stuff like that. But I definitely, Seth Bedis and I would have been homeboys for sure. I would have been right on that horse with him, you know, and I think I agree with you, Rich, in the fact that, you know, have fun now, but there's a point where it stops and now it's business time. All right, we did our thing. We're ready to go. Now it's business time. Let's not affect, you know, the team, and let's not take a distraction out there. Now it's time to roll. So I agree with that 100% too. But I'll tell you right now, I am a joker, and I would have been right there with him, if not trying to top him, doing something else. You know, whether I could ride in on a black bear and get Ringling Brothers or something to take me in, I'd have been there with him. But I'm definitely that type of guy. And I like seeing guys laugh and relaxed and having a good time. So to answer your question, I've been right there with Cespedes.
That's awesome. Thanks.
Yeah,
you honey, got it. I keep thinking about Major League Baseball, taking the piece of the owner off, you know, one win at a time. You know, like even something like that while you're with the specialist. That's something that's complimentary right there, and that's what it's about. We're going to go to Mike after this. And, Mike, you know, we're going to go the same way I went about Rich. Start with the entire your opinion about this status thing. And then follow up with JJ.
Cespedes. No, I could go. I could really go all over the place with this. He definitely lightened the mood. I think there's something to be said for reestablishing, in the Mets case, team camaraderie. I'm dead on with what Rich said. You know, it happened early. I'm all for it. I think it was cool. If you're going to do something like that, you do it now in spring training. When the games become official, you know, that's when the business aspect of this takes over and you have to really, you know, focus your mind. That said, you know, I think the media is taking this too far. They got nothing better else to do. And that said, they need spring training as well, as do fans, players, media, coaches. We all need spring training. And I think we're just starting to get our initial stretching out of the way. And I think the giddiness of reassembling for baseball again, you know, will subside. And we'll start to get back into a more even keel. I hope that's the reality, you know, coming ahead of us. As far as JJ, I'll put it this way. You know, the Brooklyn Cyclones are a minor league affiliate of the Mets here, practically in my backyard in Coney Island. So I have a lot of experience with minor league. I like to travel. I attend more minor league games now than I do pro games. And, you know, minor league players, you know, in 99.9% of the situations are allowed and seem to have a more flexible schedule for being, you know, available for the fans, conversations, autographs, whatnot. You touched upon that in your personal, you know, anecdotes. But at the major league level, it seems like the structure and the animal seem to take over. And I guess I would like your advice, if you have any, for fan etiquette when they attempt to, you know, seek an autograph from players and things of that nature. And maybe you have some insight. Because you go to a game and you call out to a player, as polite as you can possibly make it, you know they hear you.
Oh, yeah.
But they walk a straight line as if, you know, their mind is somewhere else. So, you know, not so much a question, but if you can just elaborate and give us your insight into all that.
No, Mike, that's a great point. And everybody does hear you. You know, you're right there. And people always ask me, like, do you hear? Can you hear? Can you? Yeah, I hear you. You're 5 feet from me just because I'm standing on the field and you're sitting in a couch. Listen, you're sitting in a chair. I hear you. I remember the first time I walked to the plate, it was hysterical. So, and this is in college. We're at my first school playing University of Missouri, and there's roughly 1,000 people in the stands. And, you know, my family had flown out. I'm all proud. I'm starting shortstop as a freshman and everything else. And lo and behold, the 1,000 people go quiet as a mouse. I mean, it was deathly quiet after they said, now batting J.J. Newman. And I'm walking to the plate, and this guy in the front row with a hot dog and a beer in his hand, hey, coach, get your bat boy. He's trying to go up and hit. While it's deathly quiet in there. And that brings me to the point where, you know, and then that guy can stand, you know, and say things all game. But, yeah, we hear every word. And there's times when the whole crowd's quiet and everything else. But to touch on what you were talking about, I remember the first game I got called up, and I'm sitting there, and it was Josh Tolley was catcher at the time also, but he was a backup guy just like me, just standing there. He was signing everything, you know, shaking everybody's hands, getting pictures, and so was I, and David Wright. And we're all sitting there, and there's a hierarchy you go through. I look at it like, okay, if there's some dirty old guy standing there trying to get me to sign 13 T-shirts, I know what he's trying to do. So he's the last person on my list to sign anything for him, you know what I mean? When I've got three little kids in front of me and, you know, a grandma sitting there in a wheelchair and she's in the handicap aisle and she wants a hug and a picture, you know, that guy's the last guy on. And because you don't know what he's doing with that, if he's taking it to his pawn shop, if he's taking it to a sports shop or whatever, you know. So the kids come first, and I'm pretty enlightened in the fact that kids just shout, hey, sign this, do that. So that's all good. But there are certain guys that just are overbearing. And it's rude to a point and everything else. Like, you're hopping in front of a kid or a woman with a child, and you're pushing people and you're doing things like that. Proper fan etiquette, that's when a big guy or a grown man is last on the list. I don't want to sign your stuff for a couple reasons. First of all, you know, I saw that little kid's hot mom a couple rows back, and if I sign it, maybe she'll smile at me. Maybe I'll get a phone number, something like that. Second of all, yeah,
you know,
maybe I'll sign my number on the ball. You never know. But the guy with five things in his hand, you know, it's just never, I just never trusted that. So kids always come first, hot moms come second, and, you know, so on and so forth after that. But, yeah, to answer your question, there is a certain etiquette that you should treat everybody, first of all, like human beings, and also be understanding. And it's just like you said, major, like, I wasn't a big-time player. Nobody ever heard of me until they saw me on that field. But a David Wright or somebody, okay, so he's got to be out of there at 5 o'clock because he has to go work out, then do a TV commercial, then he has to show up at a dealership, or he's got this going on and that going on. Yeah, those guys are time-pressed. So they don't need to sit there and sign everybody's stuff, you know. But there is a certain etiquette, and you touched on it, where, you know, you just have to treat people with respect and understanding. And, you know, you might not get that autograph. You might, but you have to be understanding of that person. And a lot of people aren't. Oh, I've heard all kind of stuff. David's a jerk and this and that. He didn't sign my thing. Like, what? He's not – he doesn't have to. He doesn't have time. Maybe his girlfriend was, or maybe his wife was waiting on him after the game to go to dinner, and they had reservations. You don't know, you know, what's going on in people's private lives. But I totally agree with you. There's a certain etiquette, and now that you understand my point of view too, with the hot moms and hot girlfriends and things like that, you know, they come right up there with kids. So
hey, listen,
if you want some
1986, you know what I mean? Like, That's how it goes. Like, you know, we should be understanding.
That's it. So,
anyway.
So if you have a hot girlfriend or a hot wife, send them up to get the stuff signed. They'll have a better chance.
Get this for the kids. This is for the kids.
Yes, exactly.
Before we segue, which is soon to be number 26, we're going to go to JT Turan. And by the way, I have to, between JJ and JT, I have to apologize for my shoddy introduction the last time around. JT, you have a question for JJ after answering about the whole Suspettus horses.
Which basically about the whole Suspettus thing, I'm on board just like everybody else is. I think it's just absolutely fantastic in the days leading up to the games, and I've been having a hell of a time writing about it. It's funny because I just joined Rising Apple a couple weeks ago. I think it's going to be about 3 weeks, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe two. And most of the time what I've had to write about was, I've written about Cespedes' cars. I've written about the hog that he bought and that he won at the fair. And I wrote about Familia's new bachata intro that he's working on for the new season. So it's been such a laid back spring training so far. Like we were talking in the last podcast, roles are defined. Things are going well. There are no injuries. There's nothing really that we need to worry about in terms of the actual way that this team is shaping up. So yeah, it's fantastic to be talking about Cespedes is riding in on a horse dressed in cowboy gear. Like that's amazing. That's just, it's fun. It's great. That's what baseball should be all about. It's entertainment when you really think about it. So if you know, the games aren't even starting yet in spring training, why not have a little fun? So that's my take on it. And I think we're pretty much all in the same boat and the same opinion in that sense, I think. So, but JJ, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was in your personal career, just, you know, throughout while you played, what was one of the most memorable moments playing wise that you can remember in a game? Did you have any, like, you know, big walk-off hits? Is there, you know, some crazy play that maybe you got to pull off or something like that? Maybe something you could, tell us about in that sense.
Well, we've got a couple, and it was one right after I got drafted. It was funny as anything. Never played second base before in my life. And this was just the Gulf Coast League rookie ball, first game ever. We're playing the Nationals. Turned a triple play in the first inning. So as crazy as that sounds,
awesome.
What kind of triple play?
If you don't mind me asking.
Yeah, line drive to me. Ben Saylor from Boise State he went to or somewhere, or BYU. Yeah, he went to BYU. He was at first base. Line drive to me at second. The guys were both stealing. Touched second base. Threw the ball to him at first base, and it was done. Triple play, and it was just like, hold on, did that really just happen? They tried to hit and run with two guys on, and that was kind of cool. It was just the first play ever in my professional career, first ball ever hit to me, triple play. So
that was
kind of
interesting. That is crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
What are the odds of that happening? That's insane.
Exactly. And then the best thing, and it involves Gloria Estefan, Lionel Richie. It involves Lionel Richie.
So, Gloria.
No, just... I remember. So
I'm sure collaborated, but come on.
So it was actually the game I got hurt that Kershaw was on the mound, and everybody's making this big stink. Oh, this guy's the next Sandy Koufax, and he's this and he's that. To me, he looked like some hillbilly from, you know, West Virginia that was 6'10", and that was it. I didn't care what he had going on, but I was a leadoff hitter in the lineup. We ended up having four hits through the eighth inning. The eighth inning is when I got hurt. We had four hits through the eighth inning, and I was 3-for-3 off of Kershaw with two doubles and a single. And after the game, so I got hurt, but I'm still in, like, I got hurt in the bottom of the eighth and played the rest of the game. Still walking on my knee, trying to just avoid it, and hopefully it feels better a little bit later, because I had no idea that I'd tore my MCL. But get to the team meeting after the game, and Jerry Morales, big leaguer for 20 years, he was one of our managers along with Bobby Floyd. And so we're in our team meeting in the locker room, and Jerry Morales just goes, "I just got off the phone with Sandy, and he asked how Newman was doing tonight, and all I said was, He hit the ball hard all night long. And he started singing and dancing in front of the whole team and singing Gloria Estefan. First of all, he could never pronounce my name right. All the Spanish guys couldn't. They call me Yeye instead of JJ. So he's like, I told him, Yeye hit the ball hard all night long, all night. And he's dancing, and everybody just starts cracking. So I get up, I'm like, oh, I appreciate that. Thank you, Gary. So his name's Jerry, but since he can't pronounce his J's, I figure I won't pronounce my J's to him, and I call him Yeri, and he gets mad at me. He's like, my name not Yeri, it's Jerry. I'm like, well, you pronounce it then. You can't say it when you're saying my name. But that's honestly, I still tell that story. And he was with the Washington Nationals, and they were playing the Mets up here a couple years ago, and he's their third base coach at the time. And I see him out at Del Frisco's. And I came up to him and I tapped him on the back and he just started dancing and he goes, oh, not, like he remembered. I said, that's one of the best moments I've ever had. But yeah, between those two, the triple play and him dancing and 3-for-3 off of Kershaw and not having any idea that he was going to be one of the best pitchers in baseball at one point, they were pretty good. They were pretty good. But that's, I hit a home run off of El Duque in an inter-squad game, which felt good because he was talking a little trash, saying, you can't pull every pitch. You have to take it to opposite field. And then I pulled a home run down the line, and I just stared at him. And I pulled a Batista and threw the bat about 30 feet in the air. But but it was oh, yeah. And then I ran because he's like 5 inches taller than me. I didn't want to deal with it.
He's got old. He's getting that leg up.
Oh, listen, and he's got old man strength. I don't know. I don't care how old people said he was. They tried to say he was 37 or something. He took his shirt off. He looked about 50, but he was strong as an ox. Like, he just pushed you, and you're going flying. So I was confused. I said, you look 50. They're saying you're 37, but you're as strong as a 21-year-old. I was confused about it, but him and I go back and forth all the time.
Who knows about him? Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what happened when you came over to this country.
We don't need to go into that right now. Listen, JJ, I have a question. Can you go to another 20 minutes or so? We're about to go off on number 26. Can you chill for that long?
Hey, you got it, man. Anything for you.
Oh, JJ, you're the man. I'll buy you a shot soon. All right, so listen, everybody, listen, this has been a great night, this has been fantastic, but we are on the 126th episode of the Rising Apple Report, which is pretty amazing, and most of the time, actually, since number probably 42, it started with 42, it really took off with 44, which was Jason Day, 42 was Jackie Robinson, but 44 was Jason Bay. And now here we are in the 126th, and we're back to 26. And we're going to talk first about the National League in New York in 1926, which included what currently still stands on Baseball Reference as the Brooklyn Robins. The 1926 Brooklyn Robins, which, by the way, everybody, is the Dodgers team that still exists. They finished 6th in the National League, 71-82, and it's going to be interesting when we get to the next National League team in New York, because they were both very close in the standings. Wilbur Robinson was the manager, and the best player on that team was Jesse Petty, and if we look down on Baseball Reference, Jesse Petty was the best pitcher on that team that year. And he went 17-17 with an ERA of 2.84 with 275.2 innings pitched. That was the best team on the team that finished 6th in the National League of a league that only granted one playoff appearance to its team of good record. New York Giants, everybody, went 74-77, finished 5th in the National League. So there was a battle between the Subway teams, the New York Giants and the Brooklyn Robins. But the thing about it was that, unfortunately, it was between fifth and sixth place. Their manager was still John McGraw at the time, who I believe went into the 30s. And their number one player was Frankie Frisch, who I believe, he was a second baseman. And he had 8 home runs, 51 RBIs with a .327 batting average. If the Mets didn't exist, these teams would still exist, because the Mets were only existing because these teams left. And these are the teams of the 1926 year. Going to the ultimate Mets database, and to give them proper billing, we have the number 26 in Mets history. And to start it off with, the only player to wear number 26 in the 1952 season was Herb Monfort. And I will go through the rest of it and pass it on to Rich Spirago after that, based off of what he hears, to remember what he, you know, knows about number 26. Vinegar Bend Mizelli also wore number 26 in 1962. Gallen Sisko, Bob Shaw, Bill Graham, Amos Otis, Bruce Bossclair, Dave Kingman, wore number 26. Mike Brewhurt, Ray Burris, Scott Holman, Dave Kingman again, Bill Robinson, Terry Leach, Kevin Tapani, Frank Viola, Alejandro Pena, Barry Foote, Ted Landrum, Rico Gronia, Barry Manuel, Ralph Millard, Terrence Long, a different Terrence Long, definitely, from based off of when Terrence Long wore it for the Mets, Billy Taylor, John Nuoli, Dave Lamb, Jason Phillips, Marco Scudero, Jay Sowell, Orlando Hernandez, Ramon Martinez, Fernando Martinez, Tom Goodwin. Who shall we go to first for that number? Let's see. I would have to say Rich, number 26. Go ahead.
Well, you know, Sam, number 26 to me will always be Dave Kingman. And now, I'm not suggesting I was a Dave Kingman fan. Kingman was a very polarizing figure as a Met for a lot of different reasons. He had a very contentious relationship with the press. And Kingman was your quintessential all-or-nothing player. He was a converted pitcher, which many people don't remember, but he was a converted pitcher. He was a pitcher in the San Francisco Giants system. And then he became a hitter. And some of the most prodigious power you've ever seen in a ball player. The guy can hit the ball 550 feet pretty much with regularity. I mean, he was an absolute beast at the plate, but struck out a ton. His career batting average, I do not have in front of me, but I would suggest it was probably about .220. You know, he hit almost 400 home runs. But again, of all the players I've ever seen, and I've been watching this game a long time, he was the most all or nothing. When he connected, the ball absolutely jumped and it was out of there, but he struck out, like I said, struck out a lot. Was not a terribly good defensive player. And a lot of fans, because remember, they're the era now. You're talking about the mid-70s and then again in the late 70s, early 80s when he came back. So on those teams, Kingman was something exciting. You know, when he came up, he might hit the ball 500 feet. He'll probably strike out, but he might hit it 500 feet. So he gave the fans something to latch on to, and some fans really dug him, and some still do. If you walk around Citi Field today, you'll see some people with 26 Kingman shirts. Other people said, you know, he's not really a ball player. He's a home run hitter. He's kind of like he should be in home run derby, you know, as opposed to being on the field every day. So Kingman is the guy who jumps out to me. And then with respect to our guest, JJ, here, I have to say El Duque. I'm going to have to speak a little bit about El Duque. You know, there's a guy who was a consummate pro. When he came over to the Mets in the middle of the 2006 season, a guy who just, I mean, it seemed like he had 10 pitches in his arsenal. Obviously, he did not, but he threw all different speeds, put the ball wherever he wanted to, just terribly effective, and I rue the day that he turned his ankle running in the outfield right before the start against the Dodgers in game one of the NLDS because, like I think, Sam, you said earlier, minus the injury to Pedro and minus the injury to El Duque, that 2006 team may have been a World Series team. So El Duque was a colorful figure, very good pitcher. No one really knew how old he was. No one really cared because when you're that effective, just go out there and win, and that's what he did. So those are the two I wanted to speak about, El Duque and Dave Kingman.
Yep, exactly. JJ, before I go on to Mike, because unfortunately we've lost JT Duran, and we do thank him for being on, but before I go on to Mike, is there anybody in that list that pops out to you just in terms of everything you've been through baseball-wise?
Oh, yeah, and he just put it. First of all, Dave Kingman, that's to go without saying, just legendary name, and that's just one of those presents. You know, you hear the name Lou Gehrig. It just has a certain presence about it. Dave Kingman, you don't even have to know his exact stats. You don't have to know what he did, but his name, it's a presence because of what he accomplished, 400-plus home runs, the monstrous home runs. You know, he's something that legends are made of. But just to go on about that, first of all, number 26 also, I was first round 26th pick overall of the Dallas Pike wiffle ball team 1 year. So I think we should tie that into there. I think that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
There were 27 guys. I was 26th overall in the first round. So I think that's pretty impressive. But El Duque, I'm going to go with my man. And just like I said, he left a great presence with me. And they just had that tell-all story about him and his brothers and everything on TV for the 30 for 30. And what the guy went through and to still stay as humble and still be able to want to give back and have the type of personality he did. And what he accomplished. I mean, gosh, I remember sitting there, my brother-in-law and I took a trip to New York and my sister, we took a trip to New York my senior year of high school just for the weekend. And we took a tour of Yankee Stadium and all my brother-in-law, every time if we have a couple Dr. Peppers at night, all he talks about is the guy out front was selling tickets. He goes, El Duque, game number one, El Duque, season opener. I didn't even know who El Duque was until that point. And apparently he had a great career before that, but I'd never paid attention that much. And ever since then, it's been crazy. And when I finally got to meet him, it was like, wow, okay, you're El Duque. You know, and I realized what a goofball he was and how funny he was and everything else. But it's just funny, you know, those legendary names. Now, am I saying El Duque is going to be like a Dave Kingman? You know, not sure. But to me, he had that impact on me. And I'm sure a lot of other fans, too. You know, even Yankee fans, they loved him. He was one of those personas and personalities that just stuck out. So to me, you know, I go along with Rick, you know, and just say Dave Kingman and El Duque, and just for personal reasons with El Duque also. What a great guy. Represented the number well.
I'll have to say, you know, I think El Duque, being a pitcher, and as good as he was at pitching, you
right.
have to probably still give it over Dave Kingman, because Dave Kingman, like Rich said, was the perfect 1-0 guy. He knew how to, like, you knew that something crazy might happen, even if he struck out. That was him. El Duque, when he was great, knew how to pitch. And it should be said about, you know, El Duque in that 98 season and being a rookie at the time. Like, he really impressed New York. And even, you know, being a converted Mets fan, that's where I come from. 98, I was a Yankee fan. And even though I knew Mike Piazza, that was a big deal, I remember watching the news the day, like watching the local news the day that Mike Piazza became a Met. I still became a Yankee fan that year, unfortunately. But then I became a Met fan in 2005. But I know about El Duque that it wasn't just a flash in the pan. He knew how to pitch. He knew how to encapsulate an entire region. There was something about El Duque, and it was very unfortunate for that 2016 that he got injured, because he probably would have pitched his heart out in 2006. And it was like Omar. You thought to yourself, "Oh God, Omar and I have strikes too late." You know, and with all of them, that's what it felt like with Pedro and El Duque. That's what it felt like in 2006. Even though I was only 2 years, technically seasons, into my Mets fandom, 2005 is still my number three best season behind 2015. 2012. Those are my two favorite seasons, because by 2012, and with what happened and me being at the no-hitter, that is my second favorite season still. Even though, 2006, for some reason, 2006, the pennant season, still is behind 2005, because 2005 was my first full Mets fandom season, and that's why I will always include it. Mike, I want to go to you. Go ahead with number 26.
Oh boy. I could really go all over the place. There's a bunch of guys that I'd really like to comment, but I won't. Let's stick with 2006 real quick. And El Duque. Think about it. El Duque, Pedro, Duarte Sanchez. Put them in one pile, then look across the way, Aaron Heilman. I know, I'm a glutton for punishment. I just had to go there. Anyway, Dave Kingman is indeed the man. But before I get to him, I'd like to make a quick comment about Alejandro Pena. To me, he was one of the poster children for the end of an era. He pitched for the Mets in 90 and 91. And, when the Mets started acquiring players of this ilk, Pena's days were long, better days were long behind him at that point. And the transition started to leave a very unpleasant taste in my mouth, and starting in 91 in particular. 90 was still a successful season, in large part. They came in second, but it was a fun season nonetheless. All right, Dave Kingman. He only played 123 games in 1976. The Mets won 86 games that season. They won 86 and 76. And Dave Kingman had 37 home runs in only 123 games. We had Kingman, the Phillies had Mike Schmidt. That was the contest. That was the home run derby right there. It was between those two players. And Met fans, we had something to cling to, which was Dave Kingman. He hit 37 home runs. Let me say it again, 37 home runs in only 123 games. He injured his thumb, oddly enough, hustling for a ball out in left field. And unfortunately, in my opinion, it kind of derailed what could have been a closer or tight pennant race with the division-winning Phillies that season. He was hit or miss, all or nothing, but he still made a difference, a huge difference. A difference that even Tom Seaver appreciated, because for many years he complained very vocally about the lack of power on the Mets and how he would have preferred to have Kent Singleton around, and he was perturbed over the departure of Rusty Staub and the fact that the Mets never went after Gary Matthews when he was available. So the fact that the Mets acquired Dave Kingman in 75 alleviated his anxiety somewhat. Now, 1975, let me set the stage for you. I was 8 years old. My cousin was seven. My uncle, my father took us respectively to some sporting goods store in Williamsburg. My cousin and I got into a fist fight in the store because both of us wanted to be Dave Kingman. Our parents were going to buy us uniforms that day. You know, cotton knit, you know, whatever they were made of, but they weren't polyester, I'll tell you that. They were like cotton or even flannel for that matter, because I ripped it within 3 days of purchasing it, playing with it out in the street. Anyway, but me and my cousin got into a fist fight in the store because both of us wanted to be Dave Kingman, and you know, between the two of us, we couldn't stand, you know, one or the other being Dave Kingman and you know, not being me or not being him. So, and we still joke about that till this day. Do you know in Dave Kingman's final two seasons of his career in 85 and 86, he hit, in 85, 30 home runs, 91 RBIs, and in 86, his final season with the Oakland A's, 35 home runs, 94 RBIs, then retired. And as JJ
wow.
mentioned, he had 442 home runs. He is no longer the player with the most home runs not in the Hall of Fame, but not for reasons, you know, having to do with PEDs. This guy was legit. He was an awesome power hitter. He was a Met power hitter. And, you know, had he been in the lineup in 76, like I said, I think that would be a season more Met fans would be speaking about today. That's it.
Yeah. That's basically it. You know, JJ, we usually go to our last word after this, and I'm going to go to you first. And basically, with our last word, you know, having to do with the Mets currently, having to do with everything we've spoken about. Before I go to anybody else, I'd like to go to you with our last word. That's basically how we do things around here.
Okay. Well, hey, that sounds good. And even just for the last word, I have a little story. You know, being from West Virginia, the Mets never came out as a big team on my radar, and it would be kind of like, you know, the Oakland Athletics around here or something like that. I just never thought of it that way. Never realized the tradition behind being a Met or playing for the Mets or what the Mets were even all about. You know, it was just some team that came to Pittsburgh. The second I got drafted and then, you know, played the first couple of games, got injured, was rehabbing. The off season, my best friend the year before got drafted by the Kansas City Royals, and we got a place down in New Orleans to train all winter long and everything else. And I remember going out on Bourbon Street and sitting in this random bar, and the people in there, you know, they made sure we had our own little spot and little VIP section and stuff. And I remember people coming up and did not even care about my buddy. And my buddy was like a top round pick, big projected guy, you know, somebody, a prospect. And I remember people coming up just because I was the Met. And everybody was, oh, he's the New York Met. He's the Met. He's the Met. And, you know, and I never really realized it until I got done playing. And even in New York, you know, everybody, it's just the New York Met, this and that. The tradition behind the name, the Mets, you know, and the tradition that involves the team. And just, you know, Mike's talking about Kingman and everybody else and guys that I had, you know, personal relationships with Gary Carter, the kid, and everything. And you start realizing this, and then I start traveling and going to California and the Mets fans out there, everybody's so passionate. And it's just, it's an amazing family to be a part of. You know what I mean? And I said that, you know, I got inducted to my high school Hall of Fame a couple weeks ago. And, you know, while I was giving my speech, you know, I love being a part of that family and my high school Hall of Fame and stuff. But the Mets family, when I still see guys out and go down to Florida and hang out with, you know, the cross checker that signed me, and I grab lunch in Atlanta with my scout that drafted me, and just the family and everybody that was a part of it and everybody's still there, you know, it's just amazing. It's something amazing to be a part of, and just on the fan side of it now, because basically that's what I am. I'm rooting them on and everything. And it's just, it's what a tradition they have. Everybody always talks about the Yankees and stuff, but I think even past this year, everybody realized that the Mets just took over New York City, and that's how it is. you know, right now, nobody's wearing Yankee stuff everywhere I go. It's always a Met stuff. You know, and that's my closing statement. What a, you know, thank you, first of all, for having me on this podcast. What a great time. And the guys and everything else, I look forward to talking to you guys further down the line. But just that tradition and stuff and being able to talk about it. And, you know, the pride I have of being a part of that and being a part of that history for a little bit, you know, whether it was mixing a Gatorade jug for El Duque or you know, anything else. But it's just what a proud tradition to be a part of. So that's my closing argument, that. And I hope everybody appreciates the fact that I was 26th overall in the wiffle ball draft that year. You know, I'm proud of that also. But I thank you guys for having me on. Yes. And anytime you want me on, Sam, you got it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, JJ. Let's go to Rich. Rich, your closing word.
My closing word is two words, go time. That's exactly what it is. You know, we ever since the end of November 1st when it all ended, we said, all right, well, that year was great, and it's a springboard into a world championship in 2016. You know, use it as a termination like the Royals did. All that being said, it's time. You know, no more talking. It's go time. And so I think the Mets are focused. I think they have a business-like attitude. I think they have a bit of a chip on their shoulder, which is a good thing about last year. So it's fun. It's great that it's back. And let's do it, gentlemen. Let's do it. 2016. Let's make this the year.
Exactly.
I'm there with you.
Final word. Thank you. Thank you, JJ. I thought you were a brilliant guest tonight. Valuable insight. Dynamite. Thank you. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
I'm undertaking, guys, I'll announce it now, guys. Sam, Rich, JJ, this is my personal crusade as part of my final word in any podcast I'm a part of. It's time that the Mets, Citi Field, the Wilpons, honor or pay homage to Joan Payson at Citi Field. Some kind of recognition needs to be made in her honor at that place. If it were not for her, I mean, William Shea is up on the wall. It's time to get her back into the general conversation of what is the New York Metropolitans. Other than that, you know, the pagan in me is starting to get a little restless in anticipation of the spring equinox. I think we're over the worst part of the winter. And, I'm excited, as excited, perhaps more excited than I've ever been since 1985 and 1986. So, yeah, let's get the spring training crap out of the way. Hopefully nobody gets hurt, and let the games begin.
And I can't really say it better enough than anybody here said it. That's exactly what is on all of our minds. Let's get this done. JJ, you have been such a wonderful guest, and I can't thank you enough for being on tonight.
Oh, no, thank you, Sam, and hopefully I get to be friends with these guys on Facebook, too, and hopefully, you know, you got to stop poking me on there, man. You got to stop poking me.
I will.
It's got me worried.
I'm sorry. I'm too in the 2006 mode of Facebook. I will stop it as soon as possible. But everybody, that's our show tonight. As I always like to say, especially as we go into such a wonderful season, this is a perfect. Today was the first intra-squad game, and it's the first day that the Mets can't lose. From here on out, we will see a win and a loss every time the Mets play baseball. So, everybody out there, let's go Mets. Let's get this done, unfinished business. Thank you. Have a good night. Let's go.
Have a great night. Thanks, JJ.
Good night.
Hey, thank you, guys. Go Mets.